4 days out from the Super Tuesday presidential primary elections, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump looks to lock in his advantage. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Well, following last night's pyrotechnics on the GOP debate stage, today's bombshell du jour, New Jersey governor and, until recently, fellow Republican presidential candidate Chris Christie throws his support to the Donald. What's it all mean? Well, helping us make sense of the endorsement is longtime Christie watcher, WNYC reporter Matt Katz, author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Matt, thanks for joining us once again on NewsWorks Tonight. Help us make sense of the mind of Christie. Is this more pro-Trump or anti-Marco Rubio?
There's a little bit of both there. I think what's primarily driving this is Chris Christie wants to pick a winner. And he thinks that the only people able to win who are left are Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Donald Trump. I'm told from by a Christie advisor that he thinks those are the three only relevant candidates, and he thinks Trump is the most qualified and the most able to beat Hillary Clinton. So that's part of the reason why he's gone with Trump. The other thing is, you know, these guys have a personal history. They've been friends for 13 years. Christie went to Trump's third wedding, which in fact is where he met the Clintons. They go back a ways. They have dinner regularly. So they know each other pretty well. And I think Christie is staying relevant in the news cycle by doing this. He's also obviously setting himself up for a potential job in the Trump administration.
Why do you think he's ultimately seeking to affiliate with Trump?
I think one of the potential reasons is he envisions himself not as vice president. I don't think that's a potential, but I think attorney general is a real possibility if Trump were to be elected president. Trump clearly now owes Christie. This is the biggest endorsement he's gotten from an establishment Republican, from somebody who actually has legitimate and extensive governing experience. This gives his candidacy a degree of legitimacy that it didn't have yesterday. Christie did Trump a favor, and I could see Trump, a President Trump, offering Chris Christie, who used to be a federal prosecutor, the job of attorney general. Now, this would require the Bridgegate trial, which is now scheduled for the spring, to be over and done with no new revelations about Christie's possible involvement. But it's certainly a possibility.
Matt, help us put this in perspective to the extent that Christie was the former elected chair of the Republican Governors Association. He was the keynote speaker at the 2012 RNC. What must the party establishment or what's left of it make of this?
Yeah, this is a big affront to the party establishment. This is a guy, Chris Christie, who came to prominence thanks to the Bushes, the embodiment of the Republican establishment. George Bush is the one who named him U.S. Attorney in New Jersey. That's what got Christie's political career on the national stage going. Christie was close with the Bushes, and now doing this, it's an absolute affront to the Bushes and to the Republican establishment.
The sense is that this deal came about yesterday, and that would have been prior to Trump's poor showing in the Republican debate last night. Is that the case, or do you think the endorsement happened specifically this afternoon to kind of take control in the short term of the news cycle?
I think the endorsement was coming, no question about it, and they had met a day or two ago to talk about it. The fact that it came when Trump was in a little bit of a down moment in the news cycle on a day before a weekend that will drive the weekend news cycle shows the brilliance of Trump's handling of the media and perhaps Christie's handling of the media.
Garden State lawmakers and residents were just getting used to Chris Christie coming back and spending time in the home state. Do you think he'll now go back off on the campaign trail for Donald Trump?
Yeah, we can expect the New Jersey taxpayer-funded security detail to go home this weekend and pack their bags again, because it looks like we're going to have a surrogate on the road. I think there's no question. And I think you're going to see more of it, though, in the general election if Trump were to be the nominee, where Christie can have some sway with moderate and maybe blue state working class centrist voters.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Dave.
WNYC reporter Matt Katz, author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. A full court press is underway to revamp the way businesses are taxed in Philadelphia. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that the goal is to bring more jobs to town.
The plan is to increase commercial property taxes as much as 15% so Philadelphia can cut a bunch of other taxes in the hopes of generating new jobs. But doing so demands receiving relief from Pennsylvania's uniformity clause that says taxes must be imposed evenly. Jerry Sweeney, president of Brandywine Realty Trust, is head of the Philadelphia Jobs Growth Coalition, which is pushing the plan.
The path that we've been on for 40 years in the city in terms of generating job growth has not worked. It's sometimes good to take a path less traveled. To do that requires courage, requires commitment, and requires leadership.
State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams admits getting the change through two sessions of the Pennsylvania legislature is a very high bar, but believes the Philadelphia delegation will have some leverage during budget talks over the next few months.
The truth is, the activity in Harrisburg is very passionate right now with a variety of parts of Pennsylvania that have needs. And they're going to need us like we're going to need them. We're not going to ask for a penny. They're going to ask for a lot.
Mayor Jim Kenney says even if this takes a few years, the effort is worth it.
Our goal over the next 10 years is to reduce everyone's wage tax bill below 3% and cut the income portion of the business income and receipts tax, BERT, in half. This will enable hundreds of thousands of businesses in Philadelphia to add an estimated 50 to 100,000 new jobs over the next decade.
Philadelphia has raised property taxes multiple times in recent years, mostly to generate money for city schools. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
And this disclosure, Jerry Sweeney is a member of the WHYY Board of Directors. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, five more people are charged in New Jersey with filing false applications for Superstorm Sandy relief funds. Prosecutors allege that the suspects in most cases sought money from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and in many cases, they also applied for funds from a Sandy relief program funded by Housing and Urban Development, low-interest disaster loans from the Small Business Administration, or assistance provided by the state's Human Services Department. If convicted, the suspects would face up to 10 years in prison and fines up to $150,000. Delaware Department of Correction officials say all visits and programs at a prison in Wilmington are canceled until further notice because of the flu. Authorities said today that lab tests confirm that two inmates at Howard R. Young Correctional Institute have contracted influenza A and that two other cases are being evaluated. Inmates who may have the flu are being housed in the infirmary, and their cellmates remain isolated and have been provided antiviral medication to prevent any spread of the virus. Officials also say all transportation of inmates to and from prison have been halted. 36 degrees, it's 6:12. This evening's forecast, partly cloudy, breezy, chilly. Low overnight, 25 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny. Saturday's high, 43. And then a warm-up. High Sunday and Monday, 60 degrees under sunny skies. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Thanks for being a YStream supporter of WHYY. I'm Dave Heller. Let's pause now for some music. The On Trio are three Korean-American sisters, violinist Angela, pianist Lucia, and cellist Maria. We'll hear their take on the Rodgers and Hart classic, My Funny Valentine. Thank you. That's The On Trio with a deconstructionist rendering of My Funny Valentine by Richard Rodgers and Johnny Hart. It's from their album, Lullaby for My Favorite Insomniac. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on Pledge Free Y-Stream.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, and pianist Alain Grimaud perform the music of Johannes Brahms, the Lyrical Piano Concerto No. 2. And Yannick Nézet-Séguin conducts Schumann's Spring Symphony. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999 today. March 3rd, 4th, and 5th at the Kimmel Center. Alain Grimaud plays Brahms with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Turns out student-athletes are more likely to fare well post-grad on various measures of well-being than non-student-athletes. Let's go to school with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Fascinating finding. How was it put together?
It's called the Gallup-Purdue Index, and we interview every night college graduates all across the country. We aggregate those data, and then we're able to ask them questions about what they did while in college and then relate that to how they're doing now later on in life. Sure enough, there's a positive well-being factor to having been an athlete in college. 47% of former college athletes report high well-being on the measures that we're using here, and that compares to 40% of those who didn't play college athletics. Now, we don't know if this is causality or correlation. It may be that people who are positive and have high well-being are those who choose to play sports, or it could be that something about playing sports, the teamwork, the learning discipline, and all that type thing leads to better well-being later in life. But the bottom line is there's a positive factor later in life for college athletes.
Playing sports on the varsity level, or does intramural count?
This is on the varsity level, so these would be the people that did more than just play volleyball with one frat versus another.
Men and women?
That's right. However, we did go back in and look more specifically at the type of sport that they played, and then we isolated the big-ticket sports for men, athletes who told us that they played football or basketball while in college, and these are just men. We looked just at men who played football or basketball. And there we found the same thing in general. But there's one exception, and this is very germane to a lot of the research that we're hearing about today. Individuals who played basketball or football, males who played basketball or football while they were at college, report lower physical well-being later in life than those who didn't, even though emotionally they're better off. So clearly it looks like to us these data underscore or document that there is a toll that playing those high-pressure sports of football and basketball takes on these athletes later on in life.
I understand there's also findings that moderate drinking is seemingly good for your emotional health, though presumably not while participating in sports.
That's right. Totally independently, we looked at the relationship between self-reported drinking and a variety of measures that we have on our well-being survey, and we found that people who are moderate drinkers are a little higher in terms of saying they had happiness yesterday, they had enjoyment yesterday, they smiled or laughed a lot yesterday, which is kind of interesting. And they're a little less likely to say that they've ever been diagnosed with depression or currently have been diagnosed with depression compared to either end of the spectrum, compared to people who we classify as heavier drinkers and also as compared to teetotalers. And Dave, you may be up on the research. There's a lot of data showing that there is a seemingly positive physical benefit as well for cardiovascular health in particular for moderate drinking as opposed to being a teetotaler.
Frank, are there a lot of smiles and laughs when Americans turn to the economy, or is that still the number one problem?
The economy is still the number one problem in the country. Terrorism has come up more recently, and of course, as we talked about when we look at the last year as a whole, dysfunctional government.
Is it still regarded that China is the world's leading economic power at this time?
It is. We asked the American public to tell us what the leading economic power in the U.S. is, and China is winning, still winning. Used to be that the U.S. was seen as the leading economic power, that is Americans' perceptions, but after 07 and 08, China moved into the lead and still is in the lead. 50% of Americans say China is the number one economic power. 37%, to be specific, say it's the U.S. But I should say a little optimism here when we say in 20 years, who will be the world's leading economic power? We've had a shift, and now Americans are looking more positively, and more Americans say it will be the U.S. reclaiming that title in 20 years than China.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. There were more than 600 drug-related deaths in the Philadelphia area in 2014. And last year, city emergency responders used naloxone to reverse opiate overdoses 3,000 times. And that's up 50% in just 2 years. The numbers can make it seem that little can be done to combat opiate addiction. WHYY's Alana Gordon brings us the story of one woman who's taking matters into her own hands.
Carol Rastisher is a popular woman.
Hello. Hi, good morning. All right, you're doing good. All right, bye.
Your phone just doesn't stop ringing.
Mm-mm, it's going off and off and off. Good morning, sunshine.
Rastisher spends her days driving around Philadelphia in her maroon 98 Toyota Corolla. And as she puts it, meeting people where they're at.
Right now, we're heading out to get someone. They're in a recovery house, state-funded for 90 days. They're going to be leaving there and going into a recovery house where they have to pay now. So they're working and starting the recovery process.
Is that all you have is the one bag?
No. Not a lot, though.
Steven Stakowitz hops in the back seat of her car. He's 41 and says his battle with heroin started about 11 years ago.
It's just a dirty ritual of sticking a needle in your arm and I don't even like really talking about it.
Stakowitz says he used to be an electrician. He broke his ankle, had surgery, then took painkillers. You get the idea.
It's ruined my life. It's taking everything from me, my family, my kids, my job. It's made me homeless, unemployable, and it's just a horrible existence, and I don't want to live like that anymore.
He's been in and out of treatment.
After going in and out of these places for years, they start to turn you away. And I was stuck. I was homeless. I was stuck on the streets.
That's when he met Carol Rastisher.
She told me what to say, where to go. She took me there. And for some reason, they took me.
Rastisher describes herself as an informal navigator of sorts, connecting and following up with people who are actively addicted to drugs, in and out of treatment, and the ER. She has some training in addiction counseling and says it can be really hard to figure it all out on one's own.
They don't make anything easy. And sometimes it takes me 3 days to get somebody into a detox. Somebody in active addiction trying to get into the detox with no help, they just give up.
Rastisher admits she can be a little pushy, but she says it's necessary when the system of care is strained and fragmented.
All right. You're going to be all right then?
Yeah.
All right. I love you.
I love you too.
Rastisher drops Stakowitz off at his next stop. Later that day, he'll be entering a 90-day recovery house.
Hello.
He and others say Rastisher gets it. She has a personal stake in supporting people and helping them break free of drugs.
My son was out in the streets and active addiction. And going to find him, I would see other lost souls, and I just felt so horrible. Like, people would drive by them, ignore their existence, and I couldn't do it.
He's doing a lot better now. Rastisher used to be a legal assistant, but this has turned into her full-time gig. I'll be honest, I don't totally understand how she funds her work. But last year, she formed a nonprofit, Angels in Motion. She has more than 200 volunteers. Many are family members of loved ones caught in addiction and people she first met on the streets.
Turn right onto Frankfurt Avenue.
Around midday, she stops to pass out food, hand warmers, and hugs to some people preparing for a night on the streets.
Sal, this is your bag here, honey.
Rastisher wraps up her day picking up Salvatore Morrow.
Yeah, I went in on November 20th.
Well, that's good. I didn't realize you had 90 days already, Sal. That's good.
She hands him a bag of toiletries.
And I got your razors and shaving cream.
Morrow is 27. He has a boyish face, but he's also missing part of a front tooth. He says he's come close to dying from an overdose many times.
A couple times it was outside my house in Bucks County, my dad and my mom's house.
He says he's often felt numb to it all.
Basically, what I did, I made my bed so I basically had to lay in it. And I'm learning from my mistakes and experiences now.
Since he last overdosed in March, Morrow's been trying to get back on his feet. He says Rastisher was the one he reached out to for help.
He's worth it, though, isn't he? Sal's moving forward, making strides.
Rastisher drops him off at his recovery house.
All right, give me a hug. I love you.
Mommy, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
She finishes her day checking on people who are outside, passing out gloves and snacks. It's supposed to be an especially cold night. And even though tomorrow's Saturday, she says she'll be back out first thing. Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
This week, The Pulse is taking a deep dive into the evolving war on drugs, and you can hear more about this by tuning into the show Sunday morning at 10 or go online at whyy.org/thepulse. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Brett Rader and our intern, Jared Whalen. Our news director is Eugene Song. Our engineers this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm for NewsWorks Tonight.